From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
My name is Azmat Beg. I have come from England. My son, Mazlum Beg, is one of the detainees at Guantanamo Bay.
Guantanamo Bay. Today, we'll look at the case of the detainees being held there, as well as speak with Terry Waite, a man held hostage in Lebanon for nearly 5 years, who likens his experience to those on Guantanamo. We'll also take a look at electronic voting. Is it a threat to democracy? All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. George Tenet, the director of Central Intelligence, admitted yesterday he warned senior administration officials, including Vice President Dick Cheney, they were overstating the threat posed by Iraq. As recently as January, Tenet privately told Cheney he was wrong to state that two truck trailers recovered in Iraq were, quote, conclusive evidence that Saddam had a biological weapons program. Tenet told the Senate Armed Forces Committee, quote, "When I believed that somebody was misconstruing intelligence, I said something about it. I don't stand up publicly and do it." Tenet also said he planned to warn Cheney again for citing a leaked Pentagon top-secret memorandum that was never cleared by the CIA that links Saddam Hussein to Osama bin Laden. Tenet also said he was never told that a special intelligence unit at the Pentagon privately briefed senior officials at the White House on alleged ties between Iraq and al-Qaeda. According to the Los Angeles Times, the disclosure suggests that the controversial Pentagon office played a greater role than previously understood in shaping the administration's views on Iraq by bypassing usual channels to make a case that conflicted with the conclusions of CIA analysts. The office, known as the Policy Counterterrorism Evaluation Group, was created by Douglas Feith, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, after September 11, 2001. A new study by the University of Maryland found that the U.S. press failed to challenge the government in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq. The report's author, journalism professor Susan Mueller, said, quote, "Too many journalists acted as virtual stenographers for the current administration, in effect validating President Bush's linkage of terrorism, Iraq, and weapons of mass destruction." Obesity may soon be killing as many as 500,000 people a year in the United States. The head of the Centers for Disease Control said, quote, "Obesity is catching up to tobacco as the leading cause of death in America. If this trend continues, it will soon overtake tobacco. This is a tragedy." In 2000, 64% of the country was found to be obese or overweight. Government critics say the Department of Agriculture should change its policies to subsidize the food industry for making healthy foods, require labeling at fast food restaurants, and bar certain sugary, fatty products from schools. In Britain, Prime Minister Tony Blair's government Tuesday approved the commercial farming of genetically modified corn. Britain has tested genetically modified corn, but until now, none had been commercially grown. South Dakota Governor Mike Rounds said Tuesday he supports a bill that would ban almost all abortions in South Dakota. The signing of the law could lead to a Supreme Court challenge to Roe v. Wade. The City Council in San Jose, California, Monday night voted 8-1 to recognize gay marriage licenses granted by San Francisco and other cities. In New Jersey, officials in Asbury Park began marrying same-sex couples Monday, only to be blocked by the state's attorney general yesterday. And the Log Cabin Republicans have announced to launch a $1 million advertising campaign attacking the administration's view on same-sex marriage. In campaign news, Senator John Kerry easily won primaries Tuesday in Florida, Texas, Mississippi, and Louisiana. In Iraq, the Palestinian hijacker Abu Abbas died in U.S. military custody. U.S. officials said he died of natural causes. likely of a heart attack or stroke. In 1985, he masterminded the hijacking of an Italian passenger ship during which a wheelchair-bound American tourist was killed and thrown overboard. The Palestinian Authority had been demanding his release from U.S. custody, saying Washington had pledged not to prosecute him as part of a blanket agreement not to press charges against Palestinians who acted against Israel before interim peace accords were signed in the 1990s. A leading Saudi judge has joined the country's clerics in warning Saudis from watching the new Arabic satellite TV station Al Hara that is funded by the U.S. government. Meanwhile, in Jordan, the country's trade unions have called for a boycott of the station, which they've described as, quote, a new colonial tool that seeks to polish the image of the United States and Israel. The leaders of the National Governors Association have written to Congress urging legislators not to enact cuts to Medicaid. The governors warned that states were facing the most severe budget crisis since World War II and that cuts in Medicaid funding could add millions more to the ranks of the uninsured. Mike Leavitt, the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, is scheduled to go before Congress today to defend President Bush's proposed environmental budget for 2005, which slashes about $600 million of 7.2% from the EPA. $600 million or 7.2% from the EPA. And police in Miami have set up a wide surveillance campaign of hip-hop stars visiting southern Florida, including P. Diddy, DMX, 50 Cent, and Ja Rule. According to the Miami Herald, police have been photographing rappers, staking out hotels where they're staying and watching nightclubs. They've also started monitoring all members of their entourages who've arrest records from New York. Anthony DeCurtis, an editor at Rolling Stone magazine, said he's never heard of such extensive surveillance of musicians before. The Miami Herald also reported that police from Miami, Los Angeles, Atlanta, and other cities went to New York in May for a three-day training session where they were given dossiers on hip-hop stars. Police claim they're doing the monitoring in order to protect them and are just trying to learn more about hip-hop culture. Critics say their lack of understanding is in part due to the lack of African Americans in power within the police. Only one of 97 officers in supervisory positions at the Miami Beach Police Department are African American. In Miami, just over 10% of the city's ranking officers are African American. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Senator John Kerry of Massachusetts swept all four Southern Democratic primaries yesterday, winning about 77% of the vote in Florida and Mississippi and more than 65% in Louisiana and Texas. Many of the people that headed to the polls yesterday used electronic voting machines for the first time to cast their vote. And in the upcoming presidential election, millions more American voters are projected to use electronic voting machines. But concerns over security flaws in voting machines have sparked wide-ranging public debate. Already malfunctioning software has caused confusion or possibly faulty vote tallies in races across the country, and lack of a paper trail to record votes has failed to provide a way for meaningful recount to be conducted. In one stark case, a special election to fill Florida State House seat 91, 134 Broward County voters managed to use two-year-old touchscreen electronic voting equipment without casting votes for any candidate. Now, for the first time, international monitors will be in the U.S. to make sure votes are cast and counted correctly. Members of the Catholic Peace Movement, Pax Christi, announced this week they'll post monitors at polling places around Florida during the November 2nd general election. We're going to turn first to Professor David Dill. He's a professor of computer science at Stanford University and founder of verifiedvoting.org. He's led the charge to oppose the use of electronic voting equipment that doesn't allow voters to inspect individual permanent records of their ballots. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me on.
It's good to have you with us. All right. Let's start off with this case in Broward County. It happened when?
A recent election, so within the last couple of months.
And what happened?
There was an election. I think there were about 10,000 voters. There was only one office on the ballot with seven candidates. 134 voters went to the trouble of coming to the polls and signing in, got in front of the voting machines, and then mysteriously didn't cast votes. We've heard lots of different plausible explanations, but nobody can find out for sure where those 134 votes went, because there's no independent check on the machines. I'll mention also that in that election, the margin of victory was only 12 votes. They tried to do a recount and discovered, surprise, that there were no paper ballots to recount. And they asked for advice from the state, and I think the local officials complained that they couldn't get an answer in writing. It was all kind of a farce.
And this was Florida?
Yeah, the Broward County.
Can you talk overall about the situation of electronic voting? In a minute, we're going to go to a poll worker who, interestingly enough, was given a voting machine to take home with her for a week before the vote.
Yeah. Well, the overall situation is that I don't see that there's any reason to trust the machines. And I think with elections, we need more than a challenge that candidates have to prove, a losing candidate has to prove that there is a problem with the elections. We need for the election to come with a proof that the results are valid and some way to go in there and check that the results are correct, some way to do a meaningful recount. Now, the particular problems are software bugs, which is a problem we haven't been able to solve in computer science in the last 50 or 60 years, and computer security, which is a much harder problem than solving bugs. If you're leaving machines around in polling places for days before the election, that means that basically anybody can come along and mess with those machines in various ways. So that those people can reverse engineer the software, figure out how it works, figure out how to change it, or do almost anything else to the machines.
We're joined, in addition to Professor Dill, by Jennifer Hamilton, 27-year-old poll worker in San Diego. Last night, she testified at a town hall meeting there about problems she witnessed with electronic voting machines. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jennifer.
Hi.
It's good to have you with us. So can you talk about your own experience when you first were introduced to electronic voting machines?
Oh, yeah. Well, my parents were involved in this group called Save Democracy, and they were very concerned about the security and accuracy of the voting machines. And to tell you the truth, I kind of thought that they were going a little overboard and being a little overreactive with it. But since my own experience, I'm like, where's the next meeting? Sign me up, because it's been... Well, it's an affront to democracy, is what it is. It's not that I was allowed to take one machine home. It's that every system inspector, which is the position that I was called, basically the people who were running the computers on election day, and there were over 1,600 of us, we all took all of the machines for our precinct home for varying amounts of time. I got my training 6 days before the election, and so I had the machines in my house for 6 days. other people who had their training earlier had the machines in their home for almost a month. Everyone was given the machines right after their training. And none of us, as far as I can find out, were ever asked for any form of identification.
Wait, if you could explain. They handed you the electronic voting machines to take home with you?
Well, actually, they had us drive up to a moving van that they had parked behind the... I got my training at the Seventh-day Adventist Church in Vista. They had a moving van parked behind the church. You drove up, and they loaded the machines into your car.
What was the reason they had you take the machine home?
Well, I was never given a specific reason. I would guess that they thought it was too much trouble to deliver the machines themselves closer to Election Day.
And what kind of ID or information did they have about the people that they handed these machines to? How many of you were there?
At my particular training session, there were, I would say, probably 20 of us at least.
20 of you.
Yeah.
And how are you chosen?
As far as I could tell, completely randomly. It was they were really looking for any warm body to fill the poll worker position because they just didn't have enough. And they had people that were dropping out that didn't want to do it this year. In part, I've heard in part because of machines, but I don't actually know that. So they were taking pretty much anybody who came along. My dad is actually involved in a lawsuit against the Registrar of Voters, and they were going to let him take a machine home until my mom told my dad, don't do it because it's just, it'll put you in a liability position. But we could have very reasonably had three sets of machines in our house, which would have been at least 12 up to 24 machines in our home for a week.
We're talking to Jennifer Hamilton, who is a poll worker who was handed an electronic voting machine among a number of other people to take home with her. Professor Dill, is this unusual?
There's a great deal of variation in procedures between the various places that have voting machines. However, in general, they are delivered in advance to the polling places. So sometimes it's just a day or two in advance. And sometimes the polling places are not private homes, but generally they are sitting around in janitor's closets and that sort of thing for several days. It's very hard to solve this problem. You've got, in a big place, big county, you've got thousands of polling places and thousands of machines that have to be distributed. Instead of relying on the physical security of these machines, which is essentially non-existent, we need a solution that will function even if the machines are not kept secure. That's why what we're asking for is a voter verifiable paper trail, paper ballots that are printed when the voter votes so the voter can inspect the result. That way, no matter what's happened to the machine or what errors are inside it, every voter can check that his or her vote is recorded correctly.
What about Orange County? I'm looking at a March 10th piece from the Los Angeles Times saying an Orange County supervisor Tuesday said he wants an investigation into last week's election, marred when poll workers using new electronic voting equipment gave thousands of voters' ballots from the wrong precincts. The supervisor said he would ask the county's internal audit department to review the March 2nd ballot irregularities and also would welcome a probe by the county grand jury. A Latino rights organization last week also requested the grand jury look into voting problems. A Los Angeles Times analysis found that about 7,000 voters cast ballots in the wrong precincts last week, affecting vote counts in many state and federal races. What is this about, Professor Dill?
Well, I'd really like to make three points. The first one is that what we hear about with elections are the visible errors, the glitches and mess-ups that disenfranchise voters or ruin vote tallies. The thing that I am most worried about with these machines are the invisible errors. Since we don't know what's going on and we can't detect a lot of the different errors that could happen, nobody really knows whether their votes are being recorded correctly in the votes. If there are this many visible errors, how many invisible errors are there? The second thing is that we had a lot of problems in California, and I've been wondering about why that is. I think it's because there's such a huge rush to purchase these machines because of the availability of money under the Help America Vote Act. We've gone from 4 counties using electronic voting to 14 over the last year. I think those are the numbers anyway. And the fact that there are so many of these machines being rolled out means that we're having problems. The third point, which is really the most important, is that there's a critical lesson here. It is folly to assume that technology is going to solve all your problems. A lot of the people who've been advocating these touchscreen machines very hard are the very voting rights activists who are so worried about voters being disenfranchised. And I think what we're seeing is, particularly in Orange County, they replaced one of the most reliable and accurate voting systems, a data vote system, with these machines. And I think that people are finally a problem here, and that just getting fancy new machines is not going to solve the problem for the voters. There are many other problems that have to be addressed, and many of those problems are not even technological.
So when there's a recount at a voter at a polling place that uses electronic machines, is the only thing you can get from that voter place, since you don't have a paper receipt or ballot to show who you voted for, is simply the place to say, you say, well, we hear that 202 ballots came out of here and voted for this, and then they respond, yes, 202. They only have the tally?
Well, they have the vote totals, yeah, for the individual candidates, and they can also, at least in theory, print out copies of the ballots after the election from electronic memory. The question is whether you trust that electronic memory. I think you don't. You shouldn't trust the electronic memory because there is no guarantee, there's no way to check that the machine actually records the same votes that went in. It's really very much like having private corporations count your ballots behind closed doors, not being accountable to anyone.
Jennifer Hamilton, the day of the vote, and I wanted to ask you what people were saying last night at the town hall meeting in San Diego where people came to discuss electronic voting. The day of the vote, when you brought your computer in the polling place, what happened? How did that day run?
All of us, there were four of us at the polling site who were working there, and All four of us had to get up at least 4 o'clock in the morning in order to get there. We set up the machine as best we could, and when we tried to boot up, probably around like 6:15, 6:30, we, had all of the actual election machines up, and we tried to boot up the what's called the PCM, the Precinct Control Module. At that point, a Windows screen came up onto the computer, and we were all kind of looking at it, hoping it would go away, because in the training, we had never been shown this screen. When we turned the computers on in training, it had immediately gone to a login screen. After a little bit, it became pretty obvious that it wasn't going to just go away on its own, and so we were like, oh, no. We're in trouble now. So we immediately began trying to call the troubleshooting line for the Registrar of Voters. And during that time, myself, there was a woman named Vanessa who was actually from the Registrar of Voters office for the day, although they hadn't actually shown her how to do anything either. We knew enough about computers to know to look for a program. So we were looking, we looked in my computer, program files, and then we were just looking for anything that looked familiar, that something that wasn't a text file, an actual program. When we finally Vanessa saw a set of initials that looked familiar, so we tried opening that, and a warning popped up on the screen. It said something about, if you do this, you will overwrite the memory in this computer. Do you wish to overwrite? And there was a yes button and a no button. And none of us were going to hit yes on overwriting something without getting a specific instruction from somebody. And I was trying to hit no. I was like, well, maybe I got the wrong screen. Maybe I can go back and find something else. But it wouldn't go away. The warning just wouldn't leave.
And so did anyone vote in your polling place that day?
Yeah, we finally got up and running probably around 7:30, 7:45.
Uh-huh.
The entire time that that had been going on, I was calling the troubleshooting line for the Registrar of Voters, but they only have one line, and it was busy the entire time. So it was just like, hang up, redial, hang up, redial, hang up, redial. Finally, I intentionally called the wrong number. I called the number that you're supposed to call in order to find out where your precinct is and if you're registered, and I asked them to transfer me to the troubleshooting line, where I sat on hold for like 10-15 minutes, which was...
But you finally got it.
Yeah, it was far preferable to getting a busy signal, and finally we got through, and they said, oh, hit the yes button.
Huh.
You know?
Well, Jennifer Hamilton, poll worker at San Diego, Professor David Dill, Professor of Computer Science at Stanford University, I want to thank you for being with us. When we come back, we'll speak to Pax Christi about their plans to monitor the elections in November. Then we're going to Terry Waite, who was the longtime hostage in Lebanon, who's now speaking out on behalf of Guantanamo detainees. We'll also speak with the father of a detainee. Stay with us.
Your eyes don't shine like they used to shine. They used to mean they were once inspired, now they're just routine. I'm afraid the masquerade.
This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to Dave Robinson, National Coordinator of Pax Christi USA, the organization has announced it'll send international monitors to observe the presidential election in Florida. Welcome to Democracy Now! What will you be doing?
Hello, Amy.
Hi.
Pax Christi USA has had a history of meeting the call of marginalized people in other nations around the world when they've tried to cast their votes to choose their future. And with the widespread voter disenfranchisement that occurred in 2000, we began to discern about a year or so ago how we might most effectively get involved in the process. And because we're an international organization with colleagues and friends in over 30 nations, we felt that we might be able to play a very constructive role by bringing our friends and colleagues to the United States this time, reverse the process, as it were, and help to ensure, as the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights asked, for an accountability measure that would include election monitoring.
And how exactly will you put them in the booths, and what difference does it make if there's electronic machines?
Oh, again, I think your guest just previously, Professor Dill and Jennifer, point to what could be an impending fiasco in the next election. Too often, Americans seem to think that technological solutions will solve all our problems, and often they just create more. we're very concerned about the lack of any voter verified paper trail, and we're right now we're currently trying to look at what are the most effective means for us in a monitoring role to try to ensure that that process has some integrity. I think that there's a lot of work that needs to be done on that mark. It's unfortunate that the efforts of Senator Graham and Senator Boxer and Representative Holt to try to deal with this in a legislative way have been stymied in Congress. And what we'll do is monitor the elections as we've done in other parts of the world. We'll bring people to bring the eyes of the world to the polls. They'll ensure not just the ability of people to cast a vote that'll count electronically, but as we saw in 2000, many people were disenfranchised for other reasons, simple reasons, lack of access for folks with physical challenges, the inability of folks who don't have language proficiency to understand exactly what the instructions are. And again, now this computer factor would raise even more concerns for us about folks who might be intimidated by the machines or not be able to interpret what exactly they're going to do. It could be an electronic butterfly ballot in that sense. We'll do, in the monitoring situation, what you're looking for is you're monitoring the process to ensure that everyone has a fair opportunity to vote, that they understand what they're doing, that they're satisfied that their vote was cast, that it's verified in some respect, and that they leave the polls convinced that their vote was counted. That's what we'll be doing with volunteers from around the world who will be stationed in four counties that we're going to focus on: Broward, Miami-Dade, Duval, and Palm Beach.
Dave Robinson, I want to thank you for being with us, National Coordinator of Pax Christi USA. And you are listening to and watching Democracy Now!, broadcasting over 200 radio and television stations around the country and on the internet at democracynow.org. Five British detainees were released from Guantanamo Bay this week after being held for 2 years without charge. Upon their return to Britain, four of the five men were arrested and taken to a London police station. They're expected to face days of police questioning. Under the provisions of the Terrorism Act, the men can be held for up to 14 days without charge. The fifth British detainee was released, has accused the U.S. of injustice and Britain of complicity in his detention. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld defended the decision to release the five prisoners, saying, quote, "We got what we needed out of this crowd of five people. Let's move them along." For over 2 years, more than 650 people have been detained in a legal black hole at Guantanamo Bay. They've been denied contact with their families, access to a lawyer, and the right to a hearing to determine their legal status. Four British prisoners remain in Guantanamo and are likely to be tried by a U.S. military court. Families and lawyers of the five prisoners have insisted throughout their two-year-long detention that the men are innocent and were mistakenly caught up in the U.S. war on terror. The Daily Telegraph this week reported the Bush administration alleged the four remaining British men trained in terrorist camps and learned skills such as bomb making. Lawyers for the men yesterday described the claims as rubbish and tendentious and expressed fears that they might have invented confessions under the psychological pressure of 2 years detention without charge or trial and in the mistaken belief they might face the death penalty. We start our discussion right now with Azmat Beg. His son, Mozam, is one of four British men who remain in custody at Guantanamo. Welcome to Democracy Now! And we are also joined by Rachel Mirapol, who is an attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights. She is the granddaughter of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, who were executed June 19th, 1953, in this country. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
And on the telephone with us from Britain is Terry Waite, former British hostage who was held captive for almost 5 years by Islamic militants in Lebanon. In 1987, as a special envoy to the Archbishop of Canterbury, he headed to Lebanon to win freedom for several hostages. He was kidnapped there and spent 4 years in solitary confinement until his release in 1991. We welcome you as well, Terry Waite, to Democracy Now! Well, why don't you start off by saying why you came to this country and why you identify with the Guantanamo hostages?
Yes, well, first of all, I came to the Washington because I have a very great concern about the process under which these men have been detained in Guantanamo Bay. And I identify with the following reason, that many years ago, when I was acting as a hostage negotiator, I was captured by and accused of being an agent of government. Now, I wasn't. I was a humanitarian negotiator. But I was held under suspicion of that. I was blindfolded and shackled. I was kept in detention for 4 years in solitary confinement, 5 years in all. I was denied due process. I had no legal access whatsoever. I faced execution. And had I not been able to convince my captors that I was a humanitarian and not a secret agent, I would certainly have died, and I wouldn't be here on with this conversation now. Now, my conditions were fairly harsh. But I maintain that the way in which I was treated, captured on suspicion, detained, no due process, and no contact with my family, was very, very similar to the process under which those in Guantanamo Bay have been detained. They have been denied legal process. They've been they're being held in contravention of international human rights law. And in fact, in so doing, the state seems to me to have adopted the tactics of the terrorist in order to deal with terrorism, and that is a very alarming thing to happen, in my view.
So you came to the United States. You went to Washington. Did you meet with any senators, Congress members, or anyone in the Bush administration?
We didn't meet with anyone in the Bush administration. And here is another development which I regard as really quite alarming. For some considerable time now, lawyers representing the detainees have been trying to represent the detainees' families, I should say. They cannot claim to represent the detainees because they have absolutely no access to the detainees whatsoever. But lawyers who are representing the families have been attempting to get information, and no information has been forthcoming. There's been a little information coming out in very small communications that have been from the prisoners themselves to their families, and these communications, of course, as you would expect, have been very severely vetted. But as we were in Washington, an unnamed American official leaked information to a British daily paper, the Daily Telegraph, in which information was given about those British captives who were to remain behind in detention. It was stated that they had been clearly engaged in camps, training camps out there, and therefore were a danger, and they should not be allowed to walk the streets because they were a danger. Now, to me, that is quite remarkable that the administration, the American administration, seeks to do its dealing through unnamed, unknown characters from the administration who will give information to the press where they will not give information to legal representatives. And that seems to me a further violation of justice. And we came to the United States, we came to Washington, because we know very well that at the heart of the American Constitution is this great belief that people must be treated equally and fairly under the law, regardless of race or creed. And this is a major departure from that inherent doctrine in the American Constitution. By putting people in Guantanamo Bay, deliberately outside the jurisdiction of the American courts, is into effect to put them into a limbo land and into what has become, what always has been most probably, one large interrogation camp.
Terry Waite is speaking to us on the telephone. He was the special envoy to the Archbishop of Canterbury, who had gone to Lebanon in 87 to negotiate the release of several hostages, and then he was kidnapped himself. Terry Waite, you returned to Lebanon just last month?
I did, yes.
And what was that experience like for you?
I went there, and I also went to the occupied territories. I went because I am president of an organization I founded 20 years ago called YCARE. It's associated with the international YMCA movement, and our aim is to give support to children and young people who are disadvantaged around the world, in the main street children in South America and India, and children, refugee children around the world. I went back to Lebanon, and I found, and I have found, amongst the people there, a very great delight that I was able to go back. I mean, some express surprise. Would you want to come back to this place after the way you were treated here and being were held here for 5 years? I did say, in public statements, that there comes a time when you have to put the past behind you and you have to begin to look to the future. And I said, I've done that. The past is behind me. And what one must do is see and try and assist the building of the new Lebanon. And there is evidence to suggest now that my former captors, who were at the time engaged in violent activity, which I condemn outright. I have no truck with terrorism and no truck with violent activity. But who were engaged in that activity at the time have now moved away from that and entering into the democratic process. And that is, of course, what has happened and what did happen in South Africa with the ANC in the early days. And so that was a welcome development. What had not changed was the fact that there are still refugee camps in Lebanon with Palestinian refugees who've been there for three generations. And you have children in those camps, stateless, who have nowhere to go and no hope for the future. And that was depressing. I found that very depressing because such places, I could understand, we are running classes there for young people to give them further education. But when I sat down and asked them, well, what hope do you have for the future? They said, very little. We don't have many hopes of employment. Where do we go? And then I thought to myself, well, goodness, is it surprising that where there is little or no hope amongst people who are stateless, that many of them eventually move away to the security and identity given to them by a fundamentalist religious group, and some of them engage in violent activity.
Terry Waite, we have to break for a moment, and then we'll come back, and we'll also be joined by the father of one of the Guantanamo detainees. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On the line with us from Britain is Terry Waite, the former hostage held for 5 years in Lebanon, returned last month to Lebanon, and has just come to the United States this weekend to speak out for the Guantanamo detainees against their detention without trial. Also, as part of that group, Asmat Beg, was there. His son, Muazzam, is one of four men from Britain who remain in custody at Guantanamo. We welcome you as well to Democracy Now! And Rachel Maripol, an attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights. Asmat Beg, where was your son captured?
He was captured from Islamabad, which is the capital of Pakistan, where he's staying with his wife and children, very small children, starting from the age of one, two, and four or five. He had three children at that time.
And where was he taken?
Well,
When was this?
Well, that's about 2 years now, so over 2 years now. He was taken from his house in front of his daughter and his wife and two American soldiers, assisted by two Pakistani soldiers, pulled him out, bundled him up, and put it into the trunk of the car and took away. And he rang me up from the trunk of the car, possibly he had mobile, and he told me in the middle of the night here in England that, Daddy, I have been arrested. I said, what for? It was a very whispering sort of noise. I couldn't believe. He said, I have been arrested, Daddy. I said, why? He said, I don't know. And they are taking me somewhere which I do not know. Please take care of my wife and children who are at so-and-so address in Islamabad.
Where were you?
I was in England. I was in England. I was half asleep.
And so he was taken to Guantanamo. Have you had...
No, they didn't take him straight away to Guantanamo. They took him to Afghanistan and kept in a province called Kandahar for a month or so. And then they transferred him to another place in Afghanistan, which is known as Bagram Air Base, where he was badly treated, very badly treated.
How do you know?
Because I received letters. Through the Red Cross. Red Cross people came down to me, delivered the letters, and they were having correspondence with him through Red Cross all the time. And then when a little bit of noise raised in the UK, they transferred him to Guantanamo Bay. He was badly treated. He was deprived of proper food. He was deprived of natural light, sun, moon, or anything. He said that I haven't seen sun, moon, or sky for the last whole 1 year except for 2 minutes. I'm being treated like an animal. They pull me and push me into cages. And that's how I'm here now. I get, at times, I don't get food. And my clothes are torn. They don't care. And I don't know whom to go to.
Have you spoken to him?
Never.
He writes you letters?
He wrote his letters when he was in Kandahar, in Bagram, and he also wrote letters from Guantanamo Bay when he was transferred.
Mm-hmm. He was a law student?
Yes, he was a law student, and he then settled and he opened a shop and got married with three kids.
Right now, some men from Britain have been released. Others have not. Your son has not been released. On what grounds do they say they're keeping him?
Well, they haven't given any grounds at all till now, but rumors are coming from different sources. One of the papers from Washington, D.C., called Newsweek or something like that, that reported that Muslim was making a plane, unmanned plane, in Afghanistan, which could have flown from there and gone straight away into the Bush White House. And that was amazing. I don't know any scientist who can do that sort of thing. My son was simply a law student. So this sort of allegation, another allegation came when I got favor of about 258 MPs from Parliament. Then another rumor came that Muslim was making another plane to destroy the parliament. So I these sort of allegations, a common man can think that it's very stupid sort of allegations.
Looking at the comment that Vice President Dick Cheney made for the men who were released, he said, defending the decision to release the five prisoners, quote, "We got what we needed out of this crowd of five people. Let's move them along," releasing them to Britain. Rachel Mirapol, you're an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights who works with the Guantanamo detainees. Your response to that, and also what does it mean to say you're an attorney who works with the Guantanamo detainees?
Well, of course, it's very difficult to work with the Guantanamo detainees since we haven't actually had any access to the detainees themselves. And that's something we're very concerned about, as well as the conditions under which they're being held. As far as the recent release, of course, we're happy that some individuals are being released. However, that's only the beginning of fixing this situation. Of course, it's been over 2 years that those individuals were being held, and the idea that the U.S. government can simply take people and hold them in a legal black hole, interrogate them, and then release them with no process and no review, no accountability whatsoever, is an idea that is foreign to international and domestic law. It's extremely unprecedented, and of course, we're very concerned about it at the center.
And that comment of Donald Rumsfeld?
Well, I mean, I think it speaks for itself. The idea that they've, after 2 years of interrogation and really who knows what, have finished with these men and are now simply releasing them, I think it's despicable.
Terry Waite, if you're still on the line, your response to Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld's comment, "We got what we needed, let's move them along."
Well, I think it is a very alarming comment to be made by a person in such a responsible position. Because we do have international law and domestic laws precisely there to protect our freedoms, the freedom of all of us. If we're to take the situation as it is, then that means that anybody, anywhere, can be picked up, detained indefinitely without due process, and dealt with behind closed doors, and then released when the state has finished with them. That is flatly contrary to all that we hold dear and all that the American Constitution holds dear. So it simply confirms what I said earlier, that Guantanamo Bay is simply one large interrogation camp.
What are you calling for, Asmat Beg?
Well, I think it's very difficult now for the administration to get itself out of this situation. First of all, I think it's fairly clear, as far as this country is concerned, that any evidence obtained during the last 2 years would be inadmissible in a British court of law. That's the first thing. Secondly, where does that leave us? It leaves the remaining men with the distinct possibility of facing a military tribunal. And that in itself, I would consider that to be totally inadequate, where the president, in his capacity as head of the armed services, becomes both prosecutor, accuser, prosecutor, and executioner for some, so it seems. That is a most detrimental policy. So how the administration extracts itself from this position, I do not know. And I am surprised myself that, as we are seeing such a major contravention of international human rights law, there hasn't been stronger international protest.
Asmat Beg, what are you calling for your son right now? Let me ask Asmat Beg, the father of Mozan Beg, who is still on Guantanamo.
Well, I'm asking very simple thing, which is according to the law, within the frame of law, which is justice, that Mazlum should be transferred straight away to UK, let him see his wife, his children, and keep him behind the bars. That doesn't matter. And have him medically examined, physically he should be examined properly by an independent board. And if he's fit, he should be straight away brought to the court. If he has done something wrong, he should be punished accordingly. But if he has not done anything wrong, he shouldn't be there for a second.
We're going to end with the comments of Vanessa Redgrave. We played the first part of her interview yesterday. The Oscar-winning actor had come to the United States with Asmat Beg, with her brother Corin Redgrave. They established the Guantanamo Human Rights Commission. She came to our studio Friday before this weekend's visits to Washington and talked about the Guantanamo detainees. Vanessa Redgrave. So what exactly are you calling for right now? The release
due
to
process.
The home countries?
Due process is those two mysterious words mean your legal rights under international law and under national law. Therefore, British law, international law, the European Convention on Human Rights, if they're American citizens, under American law. Now, the Supreme Court is going to decide, isn't it? Does the president, not only this president, does any president and executive have the right to issue decrees, as President Bush did on November the 13th, 2001, which create a structure outside the law of the United States? Does it have that right? And the Supreme Court will be deciding this in April. And so amicus curiae, friends of the court briefs, have poured into the Supreme Court from Britain, from the finest minds, legal minds in Britain. I'm talking about legal people. There's the sentiments of people who are ashamed. And I know that the American people feel the same way, those that know this situation. But you can't have, you know, Britain is complying with or agreeing to this word extraordinary rendition. You know what that means? Extraordinary rendition means that basically all the governments in Africa, all the governments in the Middle East, and all the governments in Asia of countries which, of those countries where torture is practiced, and I may say Russia is one, that the State Department knows practices torture, and seven Russian detainees have just been sent back to Russia, where they will die within months, because the intelligence services practice torture there. Extraordinary rendition means that citizens are being sent by the United States, with the compliance of Britain, to countries where torture is practiced without people knowing, and are being tortured.
Vanessa Redgrave speaking in our studio last week before the trip to Washington. Terry Waite, since you were held for 5 years, almost all of that time in solitary confinement, maybe you can tell us the kind of effect it had on you as we talk, for example, about Moazzam Begg.
I think I was very fortunate myself because I was a hostage negotiator, and I always reckoned with the fact that sometime I might well run into danger and be captured. And whilst nothing can prepare you properly for that, if it's in the back of your mind, you do, in a sense, prepare yourself. And the way to face it, of course, is to maintain a strong inner spirit. But I know some hostages who were captured and who for whom it came as an entire surprise, suffered very severe mental strain, and certainly the families were put into an extraordinarily difficult position, and themselves faced considerable mental strain. I would go so far as to say that that type of strain on the family amounts to what could be described as mental torture. It is totally unfair, and I'm sure Mr. Begg will not mind my saying that when I was with him and with one or two of the other families in Washington over the weekend, there were points in the discussion when they simply couldn't continue. They broke down, indicating the type of strain they're under.
On that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Terry Waite, as well as Asmat Beg, father of Moazzam Beg, who's been on Guantanamo has been detained for 2 years. That does it for the show tonight in New York will be further discussion. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.